From SBR News, this is Inland Journal. I'm Doug Nadvornik. This Christmas Week program features a visit to Feed Spokane. Fave's Spokane reporter and editor Cassie Benefield and producer Jason Jones take us to a place where unused food is rerouted to people who really need it. Spokane Indians baseball fans will be interested in a new book that looks back at the 1970 team, considered one of the greatest of all minor league teams. We'll talk with writer Eric Vickery. And we'll dig into our archives for an interview with historian Amanda Van Lannen about how the apple became an important part of Washington history. All of that on today's Inland Journal. 'Tis the season of giving, whether it be to people you love or to people you don't know. Many of us make charitable donations this time of year to organizations such as Feed Spokane. That's one of the agencies that provides food for people who don't have enough. Cassie Benefield from Faves News and the Reverend Jason Jones recently visited the Feed Spokane warehouse.
Did you take one, Richard?
No.
Okay. And then maybe I can put a couple of
tapes over here. Hi, this is Cassie Benefield with Faves News. That voice that you hear in the background, that's Crystal Ortega. She is the fourth executive director of Feed Spokane, a nonprofit organization that for 20 years has rescued food and turned it over to organizations that give it out to other nonprofits who give it away to their clients in need of food.
All right. What do you do here, Crystal?
Executive Director, Feed Spokane.
How long have you been doing this?
2 years and about 4 months.
Hey, what got you into this?
That's a hard answer. But so I'm from the nonprofit world. I retired from the military in 2016 and have been in the nonprofit world since. But experienced a pretty devastating wildfire in Medical Lake, which really drove me to want to do food, water, shelter.
Tell me something really amazing that happens here.
The volunteers. 1 million pounds of food is nothing to laugh at, but our volunteers have just hearts and want to support their community in such amazing ways.
Feed Spokane currently has 140 volunteers. This is a significant increase from 2023. When the organization had 32. Each volunteer has their own reason for getting involved with Feed Spokane. Here's Mark Albert.
I've been volunteering for about almost 4 years. My wife and I, we drive on Thursdays. We pick up food at Costco and all over. I come in on Tuesdays and help deliver it out to the coalitions. And we thought it'd be something good for us to do. So my wife and I came and did it. We've been here, going, like I said, going on 4 years. And it's kind of rewarding, right? We're doing something, helping the community. And yeah, it works out great.
I'm Joel Hughes.
And I'm Mike Panisco.
Well, I've been here for about probably a year and a half. It was mostly loading up vehicles because every 15 minutes we have two new vehicles that show up to load up for the shelters they're at. And then I've since been moved inside and I'm helping with these different stations. So that's, yeah, sometimes meat, sometimes bread, sometimes dried goods, so whatever they have. So it's a great group of people.
I'm kind of a utility guy. I'll go wherever is needed.
I got you.
I backed up everyone here one time or another. It's a fun operation for about 2 hours, 10:30 to 12:30, roughly.
Yeah. All right. Yeah.
It's very rewarding. Yes.
Yeah, I'm retired, and I felt like I wanted to do something rewarding. And I came down here, and I met a guy that worked down here. And recommended we come, if I have time, come down and volunteer. So I tried it out. And everybody's a lot of fun to work with. And I feel, it feels good that we're helping out, too. Using food, not wasting it. So it's got a lot of value.
The one thing about this place, they get things done. They're very well organized. Crystal really runs a tight ship. She works, and she's got great volunteers during the week. You know, we know that once a week, at least, I know that probably 150 families are fed, something like that.
Tell me your name, Ron.
Ron Niederstadt. I come in early in the mornings on Tuesdays, and I have a partner. We go out. We pick up stuff from Empire Vending. They make sandwiches and things like that. We rescue that food, and then we head out North Costco. We have a whole run of other restaurants that we pick up food from, bring it back to the warehouse, and then once it gets all sorted in here, then we distribute it out to the coalitions. It's fun. I mean, you see the warehouse will be packed full of food at 10 o'clock, 10:30. And then by a little bit after noon, it's all empty. It's all gone. And it's just really cool to see that all that food is going out to people who can use it. And it's a lot of it is the rescue food, like the soups from restaurants when they at the end of the day they have extra soup, so they freeze it, send it to us, and then it gets used instead of getting thrown away.
Feed Spokane's service area extends beyond Spokane into Grant, Stevens, Ponderé, and Lincoln counties. Cindy Warner drives about 45 minutes one way from Davenport, Washington, to stock up Lincoln County Care and Share Food Bank.
So what brings you here then?
Pick up food for the people in Davenport.
Okay.
In Lincoln County.
All right. That's a long way to come for food.
It is, but yeah. These people are great.
How much do they give you?
It depends. Sometimes we get 1,000 pounds, sometimes 600 pounds. It depends on what they've got. Okay. But we sure appreciate everything that we get.
Here's Crystal Ortega again.
I just think Feed Spokane personifies what Spokane is all about. We're a small, scrappy city that figures out how to make ends meet, and that's what we do here.
That report from Faves News featured Cassie Benefield and the Reverend Jason Jones at Feed Spokane. I came of age as a sports fan around 1969. I was 7 years old. It was the year the amazing New York Mets defeated a dominant Baltimore Oriole team in the World Series. It was also a golden era for Spokane Indians baseball. The Indians were the top farm club for the Los Angeles Dodgers, which was building a team that played in three World Series in the 1970s. Some of the players in those teams came up through the Dodger system and spent time in Spokane. That 1970 team featured players such as Steve Garvey, Bill Buckner, Davey Lopes, and Bobby Valentine. That team won the Pacific Coast League title and is considered one of the finest minor league teams in history. Port Townsend writer Eric Vickery has written about the Dodgers of that era. His book is called Before They Wore Dodger Blue, Tommy Lasorda, and the Greatest Draft Class in Baseball History. It's a reference to the 1968 Dodger draft class. Some of those players were on that 1970 Spokane team. This is Vickery's second book about Spokane minor league baseball. He also wrote about a bus crash that killed 8 Spokane Indians ballplayers in 1946. Eric Vickery is with me now. This book doesn't feature the Spokane Indians as the central character, but certainly an important part of the book. So why don't you give me kind of a quick synopsis of what your book is all about?
Yeah, so it was really during my research and writing of my previous book about the 46 Spokane Indians that I learned about the 1970 team, which was really one of the great all-time minor league teams in terms of talent of all time. The team was managed by Tommy Lasorda and featured a roster of a laundry list of future big leaguers, many of whom became well-known with the Dodgers, and others the Dodgers used as sort of trade chips to build their next great era.
How did you go about compiling all the information that ended up in the book?
Yeah, so I set out by really digging into that 1970 season. I went kind of game by game and just wanted to really familiarize myself with that season. It was a very memorable season for Spokane. The team won 94 games. They were in first place from the first day of the season to the last day of the season, and then swept the Hawaii Islanders in the Pacific Coast League Championship. So I went through all the newspaper archives through that season, and then I set out to interview as many people as I could associated with that team. I interviewed 11 players from the team, the bat boy, clubhouse boy, concession manager, and even a few fans who watched games in that era.
It was 55 years ago. How well did they remember things?
Well, yeah, it was sort of certainly varying degrees of memories, but certainly guys like Bobby Valentine and Tom Pachorik really look back on that season in particular as the most fun that they had in their professional baseball careers. This was playing under the very enthusiastic and effervescent Tommy Lasorda. He kind of made things fun for the team, took them out to dinner. They went bowling after games. And of course, the rest of their free time was spent baseball, you know, have morning baseball, batting practice, and then, of course, games. They had very, very few off days and a lot of doubleheaders.
This was a group that spent a lot of time not only in Spokane, but working their way up through the minors. Can you tell me a little about that?
So Lasorda got his start managing in the rookie leagues in first in Pocatello, Idaho, and then Ogden, Utah. So he spent 4 years managing in the rookie leagues, which is players just coming out of high school or college. So in 1968, he actually managed Bobby Valentine, Bill Buckner, Steve Garvey, and Tom Pachorik in Ogden. And then in 2 years later, in 1970, by then Lasorda had been promoted to Spokane, and all these players were coming up through the system, along with some other prominent players such as Charlie Huff and Bill Russell. Davey Lopes had joined the team by then. Yeah, and then they kind of sort of formed this super team in AAA in 70.
Why do you think they were so good?
You know, most of these players came out of this historic 68 draft class, and the Dodgers really went all in on offense that year. They drafted very few pitchers. It was almost all position players, and they drafted some really, really good athletes. Bobby Valentine was their first overall pick and was all set to take over for O.J. Simpson at USC at running back, but the Dodgers drafted him and convinced him to sign. And then they drafted Bill Buckner in the second round, and Tom Pachorik, who was an excellent college football player, was actually drafted by the Miami Dolphins. And then Steve Garvey was also a two-sport athlete at Michigan State. Davey Lopes was a two-sport athlete in college. So all these guys were just really athletic, and Lasorda had a knack for really putting his players in a position to win. He converted Bobby Valentine from outfielder to shortstop, and then later did the same with Davey Lopes, converting him to second base. So those were certain, you know, just really good athletes, and then kind of all coming together under Lasorda.
I remember Ron Say was a third baseman on that team. He was known for being coming from the Washington State baseball program, which was really good at that time too. So a lot of these guys then followed up, and they ended up going to the Los Angeles Dodgers and playing on some pretty darn good teams in the 70s and 70s especially.
Say, Lopes, Garvey, and Russell, they formed this this four-man infield that played together for 8 seasons in Los Angeles and formed the foundation, really, of that next great era. And then a few of the other players from that 70 Spokane team, guys like Charlie Huff and Tom Pachorik, were parts of those pennant-winning teams. Other guys they used sort of as trade chips. The Dodgers traded Bill Buckner to the Cubs for Rick Monday. I ended up trading Bobby Valentine to the Angels for Andy Messersmith, who was the ace of the 74 pennant-winning team. So a number of those guys, if they weren't part of the Dodgers pennant-winning teams of the 70s, were sort of used as trade chips to build that next great era.
I think Valentine sort of had his career derailed a little bit. He was hit in the face by a pitch, and it seems like from then on, it sort of derailed his momentum, and he, as you say, he was traded to other teams and didn't have quite the career that I think the Dodgers envisioned him having, but he went on to be a great manager.
Yeah, that's exactly right. Yeah, he was, in talking to a number of players, both on the Spokane Indians and other players in the league, he was really considered the best prospect, and some even remarked that he had, you know, the potential of being a Hall of Fame player. But yeah, you mentioned getting hit in the face in the playoffs in 70, and then really it was a leg injury 4 years later with the Angels. He was trying to catch a ball and crashed against the wall and broke his leg, and it never really healed correctly and kind of turned him into a fringe utility player. But yeah, as you mentioned, later became a really good and successful manager with the Rangers and Mets.
So is this 1970 team, as historians like to look back, some of the great minor league teams, I've heard it viewed as one of the great minor league teams of all time. What do you think about that?
I certainly have to put it up there with amongst the best, just in terms of the success that the roster ended up having in the big leagues. So many of those guys spent a decade or more in the major leagues. There were no Hall of Fame players per se on that team, but guys like Buckner and Russell and Garvey and Doyle Alexander, Jeff Zahn, Charlie Huff, these are guys who spent years and years in the major league. So, you know, it's difficult to compare the 70 team to like teams from like the 1930s and 40s, because just the structure of minor league baseball was a bit different then. But I think any list of the top teams ever has to include the 1970 Spokane team.
All right. So what did you really like about writing this book?
Well, for me, I think the most fun was just talking to the people involved in the story and kind of gathering their memories. I talked to about 70 different people, as I mentioned, even like the Bat Boy and Clubhouse Boy. I just had some really fond memories of those days. And of course, a lot of the stories they told involved Lasorda. So just kind of learning about that era. This was about the 70 season was 9 years before I was born. So I kind of grew up collecting baseball cards of these guys in the 80s, but didn't really think of them as, you know, Dodgers prospects. So just going back and learning about them and interviewing a number of these guys was, for me, a lot of fun and rewarding.
Eric Vickery's new book is Before They Wore Dodger Blue, Tommy Lasorda and the Greatest Draft Class in Baseball History. Vickery plans to visit Spokane this spring to promote his book and maybe attend a game or two at Avista Stadium. Washington is known around the nation as apple country. But apples are not native to this area. They were brought by settlers from other parts of the country. Lewis Clark State College historian Amanda Van Lannen wrote a book about how the apple became synonymous with Washington. Last April, we talked with her about that.
Apples are something that European settlers brought with them from Europe. They were an integral food source, but they were also really important in the 19th century for proving land claims. So those two factors combined made apples very important for every farm to have their own variety and their own orchard. What happened here in Washington is that apples become a commercialized industrial product. And we weren't the first ones to have commercial orchards. Some of the first commercial orchards in the country date back to the mid-19th century in New York, where they were serving urban areas. But as more and more people were moving to cities in the late 19th and early 20th century, there's more demand for food in urban areas. And then we also couple that with the growth of railroads. So the major railroad companies were looking along their territory. The Northern Pacific and the Union Pacific had land grants. The Great Northern did not. But all three of those companies were looking to maximize profits with things they could haul on their rail line. So they all had various departments looking at how they could capitalize on various industries in the Northwest and looking at different areas to say, this is a great place for timber. This is a great place for wheat. And in the case of Central Washington, they landed on apples.
You talked about adjudicating land claims. Tell me more about that.
So in the old Northwest Territory, in order to prove a land claim, you had to plant at least 50 apple or pear trees. And the idea was that you would use this species, which is a non-native species, to prove how long you had been on the land, because you could look at the size of the tree to kind of adjudicate time and how long you had been there.
What time frame are we talking about in terms of when it was determined that apples could be one of those crops that you could send back east, that you could, you know, make a living on here?
So the first conversations of this really start in the 1890s, but it doesn't really get going until early 1900s, because even though the railroads were having this conversation and they had constructed through Central Washington, they needed water. And so getting water on the land was kind of a challenge. Washington is a little bit of an anomaly in terms of irrigation history, because we did have some early federal involvement under the Newlands Dryland Act, but a lot of the irrigation projects were initially privately funded, and most of those went bankrupt. And so in some cases, the railroads very grudgingly had to step in and pick up the pieces in order to complete those projects so that they could then start farming the land.
So we know of the Wenatchee area, the Yakima area, is kind of the ground zero for Washington's apple industry, but were those the areas where it initially started, or were there other areas as well where we might know of as Apple 1.0?
There were other areas, and it wasn't clear in the beginning that Wenatchee and Yakima were going to be the kind of major players. Apples were actually grown all over Washington state. In the early territorial years, a lot of those were being grown in the Vancouver area and in the Puget Sound area. Walla Walla, with the mining booms in Idaho in the 1860s, became a very early supplier. And then Spokane also had a fairly large apple district that it was promoting. As these orchards were developing and folks were looking at how to make their farming more profitable, looking at what was going to make the most sense. So in the Palouse, for example, that's some of the best wheat growing land in the world. Sure, they could grow apples, but a lot of farmers in the Palouse were like, why are we bothering with this when we can just grow really amazing wheat and make our money that way and not have the headache of dealing with orchards and the supply chain that comes with, you know, the infrastructure, the packing houses, the railroad, the icing stations, all of the marketing that goes along with a secondary crop. I bother with that. Let's just do wheat.
Dave was telling me that they would plant them either on the sides of hills that were too steep for running machines and planting wheat, or they'd plant them down in the bottom of draws down by water sources. So was apples sort of a plan 1B for a lot of these farmers who are growing other things and trying to make more money that way?
So most of the literature that I found at the time was really divided. There were agricultural experts that were really pushing monocultures and saying, just focus on one thing and do it well. There were other experts that said, that's really dangerous from an economic perspective. You don't want to put all your proverbial eggs in one basket. So you need to diversify your farm. And so this was a conversation that was going on much more broadly at a national level as to what the future of a farm was going to look like. And so, yes, many of them were thinking, okay, this is kind of a secondary thing, a backup thing. Some of them did have success selling them locally. But after a period of time, you know, by the time we get to about World War I, this stops to make economic sense for a lot of places.
Yeah. Dave also talks about literally millions of seeds being brought out from the East and literally hundreds of different varieties. So were there different varieties that were more popular in different areas?
There were. Now, apples are what are known as heterozygous, and so they're very highly genetically variable. So what you plant from a seed, every seed is going to be different. So while seeds were brought out, what was even more sought after was nursery stock of known varieties that they could then graft on to those saplings. In central Washington, one of the early varieties that was popular was a Ben Davis. And part of the reason that was so popular is because the skin was very thick and they could ship well. I did run into accounts of farmers saying, well, I grow Ben Davis to sell, but I would never eat one. You know, I have my own private stock of varieties that I like.
Well, Dave was telling me the Ben Davis was like the last one to be harvested at the end of the year, and the one that was going to most likely last mm-hmm. until April or May or until the next harvest began coming.
Yeah. And especially, you know, with the considerations in the very early years, the refrigerated rail cars, they were shipping apples east in regular rail cars that weren't really refrigerated per se. That's something that was a big consideration to make sure that it's going to get back east intact and not raw or be too damaged.
We're talking with Amanda Van Lannen, a history professor at Lewis Clark State College in Lewiston. So when did Washington's reputation as being the apple capital of the world begin?
1920s. So New York kind of held the title, and Eastern growers were really dismissive of what was happening out west. Because it wasn't just Washington. All the Western states were producing apples to some degree. Because our orchards were new, we were able to use kind of the latest scientific advancements. We were using pesticides very early. That's not something they were doing back east yet. And we were paying a lot of attention to how we were packing and marketing. And really, until about the mid-19-teens, New York completely ignored everything until Washington started making some inroads in the eastern market, at which point they're like, oh no, we have competition, these Western apples. By that point, they were playing catch up to everything our orchards were already implementing, and they never really did catch up. So by the early 1920s, Washington is the top producer of apples in the country and kind of claims that title and has kept it ever since.
And so is there kind of an aggressive marketing effort going all the way back, you know, 100 years ago?
Absolutely. From the time people start shipping apples east, there's an aggressive marketing campaign. It starts with using the space on the apple boxes, using the labels, but There were also some larger growers who had contacts with marketers and brokers back east who were also using their contacts to push apples. We get the first branding in 1914, 1915 with the Northwest Fruit Exchange's Skookum brand. These are kind of very modern ad campaigns for the time. They're doing billboards and magazine ads. You could send off for little dolls and coloring books and calendars, recipe booklets, everything, cooking demonstrations, everything that they could think of to kind of put Washington apples in front of consumers they were doing.
Now, I remember as a little kid, because I grew up in Spokane, going in school field trips up to Green Bluff in North Spokane and walking through the fields, and then they'd hand you your Red Delicious apple. And at that time, the Red Delicious was kind of the apple of choice. How has the Red Delicious fallen so far?
Red Delicious have to be stored very specifically. And if they're not, if the temperature isn't right, they will kind of go mealy. And so what off the tree is a good apple, by the time it's been in storage, and especially with the rise of controlled atmosphere storage in the 50s, you know, where apples can be kept in storage for a whole year, you know, if you're getting those end of season apples even stored properly, they're just not going to be as good. And so consumers over the years, you know, where initially the color and having a pristine apple that had no wormholes and no bruises, like that was something that was amazing. We've kind of come back around to a point where consumers value flavor and those characteristics more than just what does it look like. And so as consumer tastes shift, certainly the Red Delicious is a very pretty apple, but out of storage, it's not always the most flavorful one. So
Dave talked about the fact that at some time down the road, the apple growers and the apple marketers got together and they decided to pick favorites. And obviously the Red Delicious was one of them. But what are some of the other apple varieties that were also have been popular throughout the 20th century, certainly?
They were growing a lot of Romes, a lot of Jonathans. By the time we get to the 1950s, it's largely dominated by Delicious. But before that, in the early years, in the teens and 20s, there were experts who were saying, look, we got to pick like five or six varieties and we got to focus on this. But growers were growing dozens of varieties in the teens and 20s. It really wasn't until the Depression hit in the 30s that folks really started kind of paring down what they were focusing on, partly because most orchards were just struggling to survive. Most growers were struggling to make it. And so trees that maybe didn't produce as well, that weren't selling as well, got culled from the orchards.
Why do we love apples so much?
That's a great question. I mean, I think it's just something in our American DNA, because apples are just so associated with home. You know, from the very earliest settlers bringing apple trees with them and everyone having this apple orchard, that's just, it's just such a homey thing. It's like literally rooted in a place with this plant, this tree. And somehow I think that's just carried on in our kind of collective cultural DNA.
Amanda Van Lannen is a history professor at Lewis Clark State College in Lewiston and author of a book about the history of apples in Washington. Inland Journal is the weekly public affairs program produced at SPR News. It's heard every Thursday at 12:30 and Saturday at 2:30. Listen online anytime at SpokanePublicRadio.org. Next week, three SPR News staff members will present their favorite interviews from 2025. I'm Doug Nadvornik. Have a happy and safe New Year.